Hello, lovely bitches. This is Monica Estrella Negra from Bitches on Comics. Welcome to another lovely episode, and this is actually our first episode from our winter break, our winter hiatus. Today we have a very special episode, and by special, I also mean that Essie will not be in this episode with us today, and that is solely because this is one of our special episodes exclusively for Black History Month, and I am so honored to introduce our guest today, who is author of Moondogs, Ghost Summer, and The Reformatory, winner of the American Book Award, Bram Stoker Award for Best Novel, Shirley Jackson Award, and the World Fantasy Award. She's an educator at UCLA, where she teaches Black history and Afrofuturism. She's pretty much Superwoman at this point. I am so glad to have Tana Nareev Du as our guest today. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I love the name of this podcast. My husband, Stephen Barnes, and I always say, we are that bitch. So what better place for that bitch to be than right here on Bitches on Comics?
Oh my God, I love that. That is so good. I'm going to go through life like letting people know that that is a thing. So yeah, no, Bitches on Comics, we are very much, you know, using that term as a power term. And we are definitely all about, exactly. So would you mind giving our audiences just a little bit of info about yourself?
Sure. I have been publishing Black horror since 1995. I'm primarily a novelist, but I've also written scripts. My husband, Stephen Barnes, and I co-wrote an episode of The Twilight Zone, season 2, I believe it's episode 8, called A Small Town, starring Damon Wayans Jr., and we co-wrote 2 episodes of the horror noir anthology film, which is still floating around out there if you haven't seen it. I was an executive producer on Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror, which is the documentary, which also has the same name partially as the anthology film. Not confusing at all, I always tell people, but they're both out there. And yeah, hopefully, knock on wood, we'll be directing our first short film this summer, which is an adaptation of one of our works, but I'm not really allowed to talk about it. I almost let something slip out. Oh, but yeah, I really just did my first solo comic called Moondogs, which was I forget what you call it because I'm so new to comics. I don't know any of the terms, but it's like a one-off.
Yes, that's good. A one-off. Yep.
Yeah, like an origin story. Mm-hmm. And this was something called the Horizon Experiment that Image Comics picked up. Pornsack Pichette Schott was my editor, and what a great teacher in terms of like, oh, wow, I can hear what the characters are thinking. So, excited to be here. And also, you mentioned The Reformatory, which I just have to say, it's my first novel in many years and has been my best received novel ever. And I, like I said, I've been publishing since 1995. So I am floored by the response to The Reformatory.
Yes, congratulations. And I had the luxury of reading it and I was very touched by it. Yeah, congratulations. That is, I mean, you know, like I see you're on Blue Sky and I like sometimes like stalk you on Blue Sky. But how have you been dealing? How have you been dealing with like the like large amount of success coming your way? Like how have you been able to like receive it, especially during this time of like such heightened fascism and people trying to target like, you know, Black creators in general. So I'm just curious about like what life has been since The Reformatory has come out.
Well, right now, the political atmosphere kind of gives me a feeling like in your face, you know, in terms of, yes, readers are embracing Black history. Readers are embracing learning about the Jim Crow era. Readers want to know. They don't want to forget. They want to learn things that they had buried from them. Like people from Florida are always like, I had no idea this reformatory was right in the neighboring county or, you know, that kind of thing. I grew up, why doesn't anyone teach this stuff? So yeah, I've just been completely gratified by it. The groundswell of support started long before the election, thank goodness. So I was able to enjoy it. You know, without looking over my shoulder every 5 seconds for what's the next bomb that's going to drop on top of us. But yeah, the thing that really strikes me, and I know this is a Black History Month podcast, And it is set in 1950. And it's a very simple story about a 12-year-old boy who gets locked up after basically a schoolyard kick that really he didn't even start. And the guy he kicked, who's like 16 years old and the son of a wrench planter, well, of course, he's not going to get locked up. So it really, it's not only the story about one family trying to free this child from this haunted reformatory, but it's also about the town that enabled the haunted reformatory, which mirrors our own criminal justice system. You know, how we look the other way. And there's so much injustice in a system that's called criminal justice. And I have to say, on book tour, which was a while ago now, because it was published in October of 23, the response to the book has been strong, not only from Black readers, but also a lot of white readers. And that's very different from when I started publishing in 1995, to see so many readers of all backgrounds embracing marginalized horror. It's just different timing, I think. This is the era of Stephen Graham Jones, The Only Good Indians, who's one of the top horror writers working right now. Silvia Moreno Garcia with Mexican Gothic. I think people are just waking up to the fact that horror, by many, many flavors, can be even scarier than the story you've read 100 times the exact same way before.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And with the reformatory, were you aiming to shed light on the horror of systemic racism, anti-Blackness?
I mean, yeah, kind of. Absolutely. I know kind of doesn't lead naturally to absolutely because it sounds wishy-washy. But the reason I hesitated at first was because the story was based loosely on family history. Mm-hmm. My absolute first goal was like, oh, hell no. My great uncle did not die at this reformatory, the Dozier School for Boys. It was based on a real place. He didn't die at the age of 15 at this place, and his name is going to be erased, which is basically what had happened. I never heard about him from my mom. I don't think my mom even knew she had an uncle who was at the Dozier School for Boys. I think that this child got caught up in the system, literally was murdered by another prisoner at the reformatory and never came home. And everyone tried to paper over it emotionally, right? Mm-hmm. So you weren't taught what had happened to him. I met a relative who was actually named after him, but did not know for whom he had been named. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to address this hole in my family history. I even thought about doing it as nonfiction originally, but it's such a grim story. Like the one I described, ew, that's not... that's not entertaining reading. I mean, of course, it's important to know what really happened. And there is a book called We Bury These Bones by Aaron Kimmerly, which goes into the true story of Robert Stevens and more of the people who were at the reformatory. But I wanted to take Robert Stevens, literally give him a better story and create both a time capsule of this is what it was like to try to go through your daily life during Jim Crow Florida in 1950, which a lot of people of all backgrounds can't really imagine, like having to lower your eyes when you're walking on a sidewalk past someone or you know, all these little nuances, some of which have continued today. There are still sundown towns today. Black people, including myself, can still feel nervous when they see the blue light or red light flash in their rearview mirror because you don't know. Mm-hmm. Who's in that car behind you, someone who's a professional or someone who is an out and out fascist. You just don't know. So some of it is still very relevant, especially, as I said, our prison industrial complex is way bigger and thriving way more than it could have dreamed of thriving in 1950. Despite segregation, it's just policing is more militarized. There's more of a school to prison pipeline, like all these things that you can sort of see seeds of in 1950, even though the white only and colored signs have come down, there are aspects of it that have gotten worse. It's just underground. It's silent. It's like people we've kind of shunted off to the edges of society. I shall not look in that direction. Mm-hmm. And unless you have a family member caught up in it, it doesn't affect you. It doesn't impact you. People don't want to look at it. So the other answer to your question is yes. In addition to making sure people knew who Robert Stevens was, I wanted to shed light on this entire system, not just historically, but as it operates even now.
Yeah, like, so I've started like delving into researching my own family's past, and my family hails from Mississippi. So like my grandma and my mom experienced Jim Crow Mississippi, which was also like the breeding place for a lot of monumental events, the murder of the Freedom Riders, Brown versus Mississippi, like all of those things. And one thing that I've realized is that it is very difficult to go past probably the 20th century as a whole if you want to get any type of information in regard to your ancestors if you are a Black American. So, you know, you have Ancestry.com, all of these things. But like Black people were not given the paperwork to actually show that they existed, even to the extent of not getting birth certificates. So really, a lot of the work is just going through maybe gravestones, et cetera. And I'm just curious, what type of challenges did you encounter as you started writing this book and like decided on moving forward with the fictionalized angle?
Ooh, you've said a mouthful there. I just read a biography of Hattie McDaniel, and I wish I could name the title of it. But she had that issue. Her father served in the Civil War. He'd been enslaved, served in the Civil War, and had to fight for years to get his disability and his payments because he didn't have a birth certificate. And the bureaucracy was not equipped for newly freed people to go through this system, even though they served and helped win that war. So yeah, that just brought back a lot of memories of that excellent, excellent biography of Hattie McDaniel. But in terms of the reformatory, I was very lucky because even before I learned that the Dozier School for Boys existed, Aaron Kimmerly from the University of South Florida had already initiated work, was about to begin exhumations, had an extensive report about the history of the Dozier School. That was a lot of the backbone of my original story idea. And from there, and one of the reasons I did not want to write it as nonfiction was all the memoirs. I list memoir after memoir after memoir at the end of the reformatory. So many people who either personally experienced it or who met writers to work with told their stories of what happened to them. And that made my job both easier in the aspect of, okay, I have a good idea of what daily life was like at this place. I know where it was located. I know how many bodies were discovered. So the facts were a lot easier because of so much research. But ironically, it was also because there was so much research that it took me so long to write this book. And I don't mean because it took me so long to read, although I read a lot of memoirs, but it took me 7 years because the research was killing me. The memoirs were killing me. These are all memoirs by people who were children when these things happened to them, who had grown up to have all kinds of problems with alcoholism and problems with relationships. So you're getting not only the story about what happened to them in childhood, but you're also seeing the walking, breathing impact of that trauma on them as adults. And it was rough. It was like there were so many things I filtered out of the story. Like you would think, oh, that would be a great scene. No, it's not a great scene. It's a terrible scene. Nobody wants to be walking around with that scene in their heads, even if you think it's fiction. So I had to add ghosts, really, and make it more of a horror novel, which for me means it's entertainment, right? As difficult a story or moving a story as it might be, I think horror's first responsibility is to entertain, not to traumatize. And I knew I would be walking a line, like anyone who's had anyone go through the criminal justice system or any kind of juvenile justice or any kind of abusive household or grew up during Jim Crow. There are a lot of opportunities to re-trigger people in a way that isn't entertaining. So I went to great pains, and you know, for every reader, it's a different line, but I went to great pains to try not to do that, to try to blunt the impact of the horror of the real history, which I'll call horrific, to blunt the horrific history with the horror of a ghost story and playing in that realm. So rather than showing, you know, page after page after page of children being murdered, because there's a whole cemetery at this place where my great uncle was buried unceremoniously, as these children were by other children burying, you know, digging their graves and family members not invited, typically, you get a letter saying, by the way, your kid is dead. It's just, this place was sowing chaos and trauma for generations, for generations. And luckily and unluckily for me, yeah, there was quite a bit of research available. See how I came back to your question in the end? Like, oh, I meandered all the way around. And then it's like, oh, that's right. That's what she asked.
Welcome to my life, actually. That pretty much is how it goes. I go off on massive tangents, but we're going to get back to the point, though. Researching like 7 years, that's crazy to me. Like, that's like a really, really, really long time. And like, kudos to you for having like the patience and the drive to do that. And ghosts. So I want to say I really appreciate the use of haints, because my grandma always says that. And when I was a kid, great. I always thought that she said Hanks, like with K-S and not H-A-I-N-T-S. Oh. So like when I got older, clearly like I got it. But, you know, I really wanted to thank you for like putting that in there, because it definitely took me back to a place. But speaking on ghosts, so I always think about like ancestral veneration and how that has always been a part of the African diaspora. And it is something that is unique to Black Americans and some horror like things that I've seen. And it's always been used as kind of like a story of self-discovery or self-determination, because that is pretty much what ancestral veneration is. But do you think that, you know, because you said that horror is meant to be entertaining, do you think that on the other side of the spectrum, on the other side of the gaze, and not necessarily the mainstream gaze, do you think that horror can like lean into that discovery of how Black Americans specifically became resilient? So outside of the white gaze, that's primarily what I want to say. So outside of that gaze, and like when we're thinking about horror for the Black community as a whole, and I know that we have this saying, you know, we laugh in order to keep from crying. I know that like a lot of things that are traumatizing to us, we have this legacy of trying to make the best out of any type of situation. And so I'm really curious about like the socio-political world that we're in now, and how horror for the Black community will develop going forward.
That is a great and multi-layered question. And I will attempt to give you a good and multi-layered answer. First of all, resilience is what I'm all about when it comes to horror. I think it's the entire reason I'm drawn to horror stories is, even if it's not racial in nature, even if it's not a Black protagonist, typically it's a story about a character who's going about their life. Often they've suffered some kind of grief or trauma, or have transgressed in some way, you know, like in the slashers, if you have sex and smoke a cigarette, you're going to die. But there's always some version of that. Grief is a very common doorway to horror, I think, because it's the first horror many of us experience. It's like, oh, people can be here and then they're gone. I don't think on one level we ever get over that concept. It kind of blows our minds a little bit, because then it also leads to fears of our own mortality, right? So there's a lot wrapped up in grief and death. So you take this character living their life, maybe they're having a bad day already, maybe they're on their way to a cabin in the woods, and then they're beset by whatever the horror is, monster, creature, alien, demon, zombie. The monster differs, but the story is always about characters who do or don't rise to that occasion, right? So either they fall apart and their plans don't work, like in Night of the Living Dead, because they can't get along. Or they come together, they have a meeting, they come up with a plan, and there's usually at least one character. We know that character sometimes is the final girl, but it's not always just a final girl. If it's family horror, hopefully they all survive. But there's one or more characters who figure it out. They figure out how to either banish the thing, kill the thing, get away from the thing. Those are usually the options. And they're superheroes to me. It's like, oh my God, you did not even know there were demons yesterday. And you just kicked this demon's ass, right? Like, we just rewatched Fallen with Denzel Washington. I mean, I'm not going to spoil it. I will say this, though, about Fallen, which is a rare horror movie, by the way, if you're a Denzel fan. He did not do many horror movies.
I recently just saw that last year. I had no idea that it existed. Yeah.
It's so great. And here's the thing. In any horror movie, whether it's The Grey or Fallen, I mean, The Grey isn't necessarily horror, but it's wolves, so they're scary to me. It's not about whether you die in the end or not. And in a lot of horror, protagonists don't survive. I mean, I don't want to spoil a bunch of them, but I can think of a bunch of horror movies right now that do not end well for the protagonist. So it's not always about whether they live or die, or it's about how you draw up your reserves, how you stand up straighter, how you pick up a weapon and fight. That is the point. The point is to fight back. So in the reformatory, from day one, Gloria, the older sister, knows she wants to try to get her brother out of this place. 12-year-old Robert knows the minute he walks into this reformatory, oh, hell no, I have to get out of here. That's their single focus in the whole story. And that the resourcefulness, really, it's the hopefulness. Because as horrible as every headline is I've been seeing in the past couple weeks, and they are, some of them would be funny if they weren't so tragic. I mean, we are entering sort of the comic book supervillain stage of American history. And it's very frightening to us, and it's frightening to the rest of the world. I mean, if you really think about it, you can see the seeds. It's not that shocking. But still, we thought we had put out some of these fires, and instead we allowed them to keep simmering beneath the surface, and now they've exploded in our face, and that's what happens. So all of us are now characters in this horror movie. And the one nutrient that I think is important for African-Americans, as well as anybody who is living in an oppressive society, is that you have to have some kind of hope. If there's no hope in a horror movie, then why even have the meeting where you try to figure out how to get rid of the demon? Why even get out of bed? Why not just trip and fall like Barbara and Night of the Living Dead? Unless someone's going to come rescue you, you're going to get murdered by the zombies, right? In real life, we can't expect someone to pick us up if we trip. We've learned this. We have learned that all of those agencies and all of those safeguards and safety nets are at risk right now. And that's what's so scary, is like you thought, oh, this is what a government is for. And then people come into power and they're like, is it really? So I think one of the reasons my late mother, Patricia Stevens Dew, loved horror was because she found hope in those stories. I mean, on the one level, she was a superhero to me because she and my father, John Dorsey Dew Jr., were part of that civil rights generation, you know, bringing down the white only and colored signs, the Voting Rights Act, which we're seeing rolled back, the Civil Rights Act. All that happens under their watch. They're risking their lives for that. But for the rest of her life, my mother was terrified that the clock would turn back because she knew. She knew that the people who were against integration had not just disappeared and vanished, and that they had lost all of their power and control, or weren't just biding their time, or that these weren't going to be intergenerational battles. She knew this. She did not live to see Trump elected, but she would not have been surprised the first time anyway. Second time, I think she might have been a little surprised, but that's the nutrient. And I think that's why horror can be a really, really powerful tool for people who like horror. Not everybody likes horror. I mean, I've heard about these people who don't like horror, but if you like it, it's like so many things, the rush of being scared in a safe way. That's just so different from feeling scared because you're watching the news. It's like safe. Like, it's like, oh, that's not even real. Like, it, so it validates that feeling of fear, and you get to sort of wallow in it for a while in a safer context. But you're also watching example after example of survival behaviors or non-optimal behaviors, both of which are teaching you literal things that you can do if someone's trying to break down your door. If you find yourself in a natural disaster and you have to grab a bag and run, which is happening a lot in Southern California. I mean, that is a horror movie come to life. But when you watch them or read it for so long, I really believe that not only does it help you deal with it better emotionally, because it's not shocking that things fall apart. It's like, yeah, I watch things fall apart every day. I know things fall apart. You know? Yeah. And I think moving out of shock is the hardest part for some people. And we all know what happens to characters in horror movies who are just frozen in shock.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do. Unfortunately.
Yes, we do. And we don't want to be those characters, do we?
We do not.
No, we don't.
We want to be in action. Absolutely. Thank you. That's the message for me today, is just to keep on moving. And actually, so I recently just listened to your most recent episode of the Life Writing Podcast that you do with your husband, Stephen Barnes. And you were talking about how despair can affect your work. And myself as a writer, and I'm currently in school full time for filmmaking, I admittedly have felt stunted. Even though I deleted all of my social media, except for Blue Sky, I'm not doom scrolling. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't really that hard. Like, once I started, like, you know, obsessing over certain threads that did not directly involve me at 2 a.m., that's when I was like, I think this is the time to actually, like, stop. But I would admit that, like, my work has, like, teetered off a bit because there's always this lingering question in the back of, like, you know, why does it matter if everything is going to shit, you know? I'm just curious, you know, like, and you've been writing for a while and you've been in the film industry for a while. And I know that also the film industry has also been going through a bunch of things lately because of all the mergers, AI, artificial intelligence, like taking over everything. And I just want to know, like, what kind of, do you have any rituals that, like, will help you maintain, like, that type of optimism about your work, about the industry as a whole?
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. The first and foremost one is the writing itself. Mm-hmm. No question about it. That is the ritual that is the most healing for me, is actually writing. But it's not enough. And the more pressure I feel, the more I realize it's not enough. So over the years, I've started adding meditation, right? I use the Calm app. Other people can use other things. The point is just to pull yourself out of your head, to concentrate on breathing and stillness and live in the moment. And when you're living in the moment, by very definition, you're not worried about what's happening in an hour and you're not worried about what happened yesterday. Mm-hmm. Learning how to live in the moment is a great tool. Like, for instance, if you see a social media post about an executive order that probably won't even stand up in court, but it's really startling when you see it and you're like, oh my God, and you're feeling that fear. Living in the moment is what reminds you, you know what? That's what he wants to do. It hasn't happened yet. And I have learned not to stress out about things that haven't happened yet. I think that is very important. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that's already happening. If we're stretching, if we're worried about things that haven't happened yet, we're never going to get out of bed every day. Walking every morning is something I do. Sometimes I'm listening to audiobooks. Sometimes I'm going over what I wrote the day before. I enjoy the nature, looking at the mountain, looking at the trees, all of that. And now music, I just instinctively knew that 2025 was going to need even more tools. So I'm just going to say that about 10 years ago, I got pretty good at a little thing called Rock Band.
Okay.
And discovered in the course of playing Rock Band on drums and getting all the way through the game on hard playing drums that I might want to be a drummer. And it was kind of a long-held dream that I set aside. I don't even play Rock Band anymore. We lost our set. And it's expensive to replace it. So I finally got myself an electronic drum kit, like a real instrument that I can put on headphones and I don't have to bother my family all the time while I'm practicing. But to my shock and surprise, not only have I remembered a lot of what I learned playing Rock Band, a lot of it actually maps over to playing drums. So because I already play piano, I know how to read sheet music. Drum music is a little bit different. I'm still figuring it out. But I'm very good at improvisation on drums. I didn't know. I really didn't know this because on Rock Band, you don't have room for improvisation. The whole point is to follow, you know, paint by number. So I'm just going to say it. I'm a drummer and I am leaning into it. Like, the reason I can say I'm a drummer is because I practice almost every day. So if I tell writers, if you're writing every day, you're a writer. Why shouldn't I be a drummer if I'm drumming every day?
That's awesome. So you're a gamer too?
I mean, back in the day, we used to play Rock Band. We used to play, what were the war games? You know, the World War II, Call of Duty. I went through those phases. We haven't picked up a PlayStation in a long time, but yeah, Steve and I went through, I mean, shoot, Rock Band was my game. I've even found YouTube videos where people have posted videos of the Rock Band notes Mm-hmm. So you can play along to your favorite song on the electronic drum kit, but you're following the rock band notes. And I think I'm in heaven.
That is awesome. And I love that, like, there's a community that's keeping Rock Band alive, because I used to love Guitar Hero and I play bass. And Guitar Hero was kind of like my therapy. I would just like zone out and just play that for hours.
Yes.
Songs that I probably never would have listened to. But like when I hear it on the radio now, all I can do is just like have the muscle memory of my fingers like on the buttons of the guitar.
It's just too bad it doesn't map over as well for guitar.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's too bad because the drummer, I'm telling you, if you can play hard on Rock Band, you're really more than halfway there to figuring out how to be a drummer.
That's so awesome. And your husband, Steve, and yourself, you wrote A Small Town for The Twilight Zone by Jordan Peele, and you've collaborated on multiple projects together. Do you have any sound advice for working with your significant other?
So funny. Yes. In a nutshell, first of all, you have to be sure that's what you want to do. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. So I would say start small. Start with a small collaboration and see how it goes. See how that dynamic works. And what works for us is something Steve learned, because he's done a lot of collaborations. I was the one who had to sort of figure out how to collaborate. He had had lots of practice doing it. Mm-hmm. Because for me, writing was very personal, right? Letting someone into your space. But I prefer to collaborate on screenwriting because it has different muscles than the ones I use writing prose. And the rule is one person has the kill switch. Like one, even though like the small town episode, we wrote it together. When we went in to pitch at the Twilight Zone, we had a list of like five or six ideas. And some of them were mine and some of them were Steve's, even though we both worked on all of them. The one they picked was one of Steve's ideas. Okay. One of the ones that he had nurtured and brought. So he had the kill switch. Mm-hmm. That means that he has the final say. Like, we're arguing, if I think it should be this and he thinks it should be that, he wins. And if you think that sounds too hard, then maybe you don't need to collaborate with your significant other. Now, but on the other hand, though, the person who has the kill switch has an even deeper responsibility to be a good listener and to think about what's best for the story. Because creators always, like I was in a writer's room for Crystal Lake with Brian Fuller, which unfortunately that version of Crystal Lake will not be going, but
oh,
it was
no.
The best. I know, it's just unfortunate, but it happens all the time in TV. I just wish it hadn't happened this time. But as I was sitting in that writer's room with Brian and his second and all those other writers, it dawned on me, you know, anybody at this table could be a showrunner for a show about Friday the 13th. Like, we all love the show. We all know the show inside and out. Everybody could have done the show. But when you're working with a showrunner, it's the showrunner's show. Mm-hmm. And that's how you keep order. That's how the meetings don't just descend into chaos. Because at a certain point, either the showrunner says he likes it or he doesn't. And if he doesn't, you move on. Done. And you might try to sneak in that pitch later, like dressing it up a little bit differently. Or sometimes you might even hear somebody else at the table say the exact thing you said, but they have a different position of authority than you do. They're more experienced. So it just sounds different coming from them. You just have to accept that. So collaborating is kind of like a mini writer's room. And the person who's in charge of the project is like the showrunner. And that model really helps us. Like, we've gone back and forth. There are some projects where it's Steve. There are some projects where it's me. And the danger of being in charge and having that ability to say no is if you're working out of ego, just because you like your idea better, you might actually make the project worse. Okay. And you always have to think about what's best for the project first. And it's tough. And it's, you know, be prepared for some arguments. Mm-hmm. One of our rules early on was we never let the collaboration spill into our personal life. Easier said than done, by the way. Much easier said than done. If you have like a knockdown, drag out argument about the direction of a creative project you're both passionate about, it's going to be a little chilly later. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I will say practice makes perfect. And we've gotten to the point now where we've been collaborating for so long. We've been married for 25 years. And I would say that our collaboration started to really gel In 2019, you know, when we started writing more original scripts, we really had to think about whether collaborating was what we wanted to do. And we chose it. We like, yes, we do. We want to keep collaborating. So let's figure it out. Let's practice. Let's get better at it. And right now, I think we're flying.
That's so awesome. And that's also really good advice. And how was the experience writing that episode for Twilight Zone and working with Jordan Peele?
I mean, come on. Peak experience.
Yeah.
First of all, this is my first television credit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, my first television credit was for The Twilight Zone. So that alone is amazing. And what made it awesome was that it was related to my job at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Get Out first came out, I was talking about it all the time in social media. And I said, oh, I'm going to have a class called The Sunken Place to talk about the history of Black horror. And when a reporter wrote an article about that, Monkey Paw Productions, Jordan Peele's company, followed me on Twitter back in the day. And you know what happens when someone follows you and you're already following them. You can send DMs.
Yeah.
So I was in the DMs. Like, I'm in the DMs. I'm like...
Immediately.
Immediately. In the, oh, Monkey Paw's following me? Da-da-da-da. Let me type him a little note. Welcome to me. And I basically just put it out there. It'd be great if Jordan Peele could come visit my class. Now, this was in the day when not that many people were teaching Get Out. Mm-hmm. I don't think he really knew yet what was it, because he hadn't won the Oscar yet. You know what I mean? I caught him when he didn't quite yet fully understand the impact he was having. So mm-hmm. I was very lucky to get him to come in person to my class, not once, but three times.
Oh, okay.
Three times. Even came and did a Skype interview. For this will date the story, so you know how long ago we're talking about. When I decided to launch a digital download version of my Black horror class, but for people who aren't at UCLA, and also it includes an interview with the late Tony Todd, I should point out. So people who are piqued by this, like, oh, that sounds interesting. It's sunkenplaceclass.com, still for sale. sunkenplaceclass.com. But yeah, it was, and as a result of him coming to the class, we got to pitch at Monkey Paw. I was too late for Lovecraft Country, which would have been my dream, but they had already staffed that room. I mean, it was clear though, he was just trying to find ways to work with us.
Right.
And that's very interesting when you look at how difficult it is to break into Hollywood and people say, well, it's all connections and it's all who you know. I mean, there is some truth to that, because if someone has a good feeling toward you and wants you to succeed, they will bend over backwards to find a way to fit you in their system, right? Whereas if you're coming from the complete outside, it could be tough. But the good news is it's possible to meet people. It's possible to come across people by going to screenings, by going to film festivals, participating in Q&As. I mean, people do come out of their Hollywood shells and interact with the public in very specific ways. I found this way. We didn't get anywhere season one. But season two, they got back in touch and were like, oh, we're so sorry we couldn't find a way to fit you in season one, but we really want to make this work in season two. This is what I'm talking about.
Okay.
That's not normal. Okay. And okay. that was when we circled around a small town and boom, everything else was a dream. And as a matter of fact, it was the last thing I did before COVID shut down was a set visit. I wish I had known more about being a television writer. In television, the writer is really more of an authority figure on set than the director, which I had no idea. I've shown up on set.
I had no idea either. Wow. Okay.
I didn't. So I'm like all wide-eyed and like looking as like, oh my God, they're doing it. And so it was peak. It was an absolute peak experience. And so excited to have had it. And Jordan Peele was delightful to work with.
Excellent. If you're a fan of the podcast and want to hear even more excellent interviews, get sneak peeks into everything else we're up to, and be the first to know what's up with the lovely bitches, we hope you'll join us on Patreon at patreon.com/queerspec, where we already have hundreds of bonus episodes and other content, and add more every month, usually. Dogs. Would you consider yourself to be an avid comic book reader in general, or were you particularly interested by this project?
I have been dipping my toes into comics, would be the most honest way to say it. Mm-hmm. You know, I had done a really, really, really short sort of Black history comic for Reginald Hudlin's Milestones in History series a couple years back. Steve and I co-published The Keeper, our first mm-hmm. graphic novel, but that was an accident. That was a screenplay. Mm-hmm. That again, we almost got set up actually with Jordan Peele, but the studio said no, in all honesty. Oh. So that was an interesting day when we found that out. Mm. But I still hear his voice in my head. We love The Keeper. It's like in a loop in my head, Jordan Peele saying, we love The Keeper. But anyway, it became a graphic novel. And that's how I make the joke about not realizing that characters could have thoughts, because it was a screenplay and it was such a literal translation of the script.
Yeah,
there were no thought bubbles, no cat anywhere in the hole. So with Moondocks, Pornchak was like, you know, your character could actually think things that they don't say out loud. And I remember that because when I was a kid, and that was when I read comics, to answer your question, I was reading things like Archie, okay, mm-hmm. Maybe some horror comics. Those were probably my favorite at garage sales. I would come across these like really splashy and gory looking horror comics that I loved. But I would say I was not really a comics reader. And even during this period with The Keeper and working on Moondogs, and Steve and I did something for an upcoming anthology called Shook Part 2. We did a story together for that one. I have trouble even knowing how to read comics, like which panel comes next. And I'm still training my eye to absorb this new kind of storytelling. So it's been a long time since I was a kid that I was reading comics. Where I don't remember struggling as a kid, but you know, when you're an adult, mm-hmm. it's just not, I'm not used to it anymore. So I consider myself a learning comics writer, but Pornchak wanted to create this whole project, the Horizon Experiment, as a way, and he's such a community builder, as a way to bring marginalized voices more front and center in the comics industry. And specifically writing work where no one could look at it for adaptation and say, oh, I love this story, but do the characters have to be Black? Which is a thing. It's a thing. I've heard it in meetings.
Are you serious? Like people have said that to you, like to your face?
They say it behind your back, but definitely I've had it said to my face. And it's an eye-opening. The Good House was one pitch, which is, it has roots in Vodou, by the way. So... Mm-hmm. Clearly a Black family. But I mean, My Soul to Keep, an executive said, yeah, we've been looking at the script and, you know, we were wondering if the character... Now, that's about a 500-year-old immortal who's Ethiopian, who's been enslaved. I mean, yeah, they do have to be Black. But that was the whole purpose of the Horizon Experiment, was to have all these stories from different backgrounds. And since I'm from Miami, I wanted to pay an homage to my hometown and how loony it is out, down there. It really is the Wild West in Miami, and create a young Black family who have some, I don't know, Moondogs. I don't think it's too spoilery to say it's about werewolves, but they don't call themselves werewolves. And it's a mixed family, you know, an East African tradition and an African-American tradition. And how you navigate power, I think, would be the best way to describe this story. Like, if you have this power, how can you navigate it without being a feral, which is a wild dog?
I mean, if it works, it works. Have you heard of Diary of a Mad Black Werewolf by Micheline Hess?
I have not. Is that a comic?
It is a comic. I actually did an interview with her when I wrote for Sci-Fi Fangirls back in 2018. And the premise is there's a group of young Black women who live in New York City, and they have like their own clique of werewolves, and they go out and they attack police officers and like save people from like being victims of like police brutality or like white supremacists, things like that. And like I had thought about that when I was reading Moondogs, but one thing that in particular that stood out for me was East African folklore, like the East African hyenas. How did that come about?
I just wanted to do something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's something I always try to do when I'm writing in a very familiar trope, which a lot of my books are. Like, The Good House is my version of a haunted house story, but it's also demon possession, which is what makes it different. Mm-hmm. So Moondogs, I wanted to write about the normal things. I mean, you got to have a little bit of the moon on the cover, obviously, and there's moon worship, and the moon is important. But what if there were some differences in this family that were cultural? And what Pornstock kept saying was a minority within a minority, which I thought mm-hmm. was great, because you're already a minority because you're a lycanthrope. Mm-hmm. But what if you're also, like in Fledgling, what Octavia Butler did by having this genetically enhanced black vampire, which made her basically impervious to sunlight. And, you know, you saw that also in Blade, who is also a daywalker. So it's just, how do you add a new element, a slightly fresh element, to make the story a little bit different?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I can't help but think of a minority within a minority, thinking about intersectionality and like how identities in this country are constantly policed and what it takes to be a person who has multiple marginalized identities and how we navigate the world. And, you know, being a werewolf and being black, I'm just going to put myself in this situation. If I were a werewolf and also a queer and like leftist, whatever else, I have to think about like how the world would be receptive to me, but also how the world would be receptive to my own art. And I'm curious, you know, because you've been in both like the literary world and also in film, how have you maintained your own distinct voice in every project that you've ever pitched or ever created? And do you have any advice on how to stay true to yourself and your own voice?
That's a very good question, and it's a tough question. And it's a thing I think artists need to be really vigilant about. Because I just mentioned earlier in this podcast, I was raised by civil rights activists. So I knew a lot about Black history. We were practically homeschooled on Black history. We had Black comic books, forgot to mention it, Black history comic books. That was how I learned about some famous Black history figures, because my mom went out and found every way she could to help us love ourselves and know our history. And yet, with all that, by the time I got through college, I was writing white characters. Mm. And I wasn't writing white characters because I thought that would sell better. At least that would have been a reason. I was writing white characters because after exposure to canon, I had literally been erased from my own imagination. Mm. To me, a story, it wasn't even a horror story. Like, I started writing fantasy and science fiction as a kid and didn't even know I was a horror writer until long after I graduated from college, because my idea of a story was a white man having an epiphany. So I was being trained in the vein of a literary white male writer, and that was what a story looked like. And holy cow. I mean, I guess eventually I could have been published doing that. But why would I want to write about people who are so different than I am when I could write from my own wealth of stories and my interactions in society? And it just took a lot to jar me out of that. So it was Mama Day by Gloria Naylor that helped me see, oh, Black women, you can write Black women. You can write having a metaphysical experience. And then Anne Rice, interviewing her for the Miami Herald, what a godsend. She set me straight. She didn't know I was a writer. You know, I didn't tell her, but I geared my questions so that they would be helpful to me at that juncture. And sure enough, she made me feel proud at the idea of writing genre, mm-hmm. you know, because she was proud. She'd been criticized for writing about vampires, and she had such a lofty, sweeping reason that she was laughing all the way to the bank. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to see what story is not something that I would turn in an MFA program. Like, what would I write just for me? And it turned out to be The Between, my first novel, mm-hmm. which was a Black male protagonist, not a woman yet. I was still working my way to writing Black women. But it was a huge leap because it was a character like my family. They lived in the suburbs, you know what I'm saying? Like, so they were dealing with that fish out of water being like one of the only Black families in their neighborhood, which is how I grew up. There was a social worker and a lawyer. I basically reversed my parents' vocations, and I was writing us. And it was about racism as the monster. He's being chased through his nightmares by a white supremacist. And it was revelatory. So it's not surprising that that would literally be the first thing I ever published. After years and years and years of trying to play short stories that had generic white characters having generic experiences. It's like, wow, I wonder why I wasn't selling, right? How about you write your own truth? And I think luckily we're in an era of publishing where there's so much diversity in publishing and inclusivity that no matter what your background, someone can show you an example of an anthology of writing from people just like you, right? So if you're trans, if you're indigenous, if you're a Black horror-loving woman, whatever, there's something out there that's already proof of concept. Whereas for me, I had never read a horror novel by a Black writer. Mm-hmm. Mama Day, you might be close, but I don't even think I would consider it horror, honestly. I hadn't even discovered Octavia Butler, unfortunately, for a long time. If I had come across Octavia Butler's work when I was in high school, that would have been life-changing for me because she was unapologetically writing about Black women protagonists. And that just had escaped me, by the time I got through grad school.
Yeah. No, I think about like when I was growing up and I found out about Zora Neale Hurston and I read Their Eyes Were Watching God. And
she
was very much like, I'm writing stories for Black people. Like, this is what I'm doing. And she had like a really rough life. Like, I'm not going to go outside of that. But I also think about Toni Morrison and like The Bluest Eye and like how she was very much like, I'm going to like write about my experiences. But sometimes that could be like a bit hard when you're trying to make a living and you're trying to figure out what will stick and what will actually relate to like whatever target audience I'm giving, but also a blanket, because I feel like good literature should not be racialized. Like, if it's a good story, it's a good story. And if you can't relate to it, it doesn't matter what your identity is. You can identify with the character and like identify that like the human experience is universal and we ultimately experience the same things no matter where we come from.
All of that. Samuel R. Delaney, who was winning all kinds of prizes in science fiction in the 1960s, wasn't really leaning into race that much. I mean, he had a biracial starship captain in Nova, but they put a white man on the cover, And there was only one mention of race. Like, imagine that far in the future, out in the universe, who cares at that point? I mean, really, it was not even that much of a conversation, but it was enough of a conversation in the 1960s that some artists decided, oh, hell no, I'm not going to put that Black person on the cover of this book. But he would also write about queerness. He would also write, a lot of things that are, or slavery metaphors, things that would be of interest to a marginalized person, but not necessarily about Blackness. And, the way I've come to look at it now, I mean, I just haven't looked back. I know my husband has written a lot of collaborations with Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell, where those characters were white. A lot of his early television was white characters. And that was basically what people did. I mean, if you weren't, especially in television writing, if you weren't writing white scripts, you weren't writing scripts. There wasn't even a Black drama until just the day before yesterday, as far as I'm concerned. So that wasn't even an option. But I think now, because there is so much inclusivity, I would just ask artists to sort of sit with, like, if you've made a decision to divert from who you are, make sure you're doing it for deep creative reasons that feed you, mm-hmm. not because you think you'll be rejected for doing something else. Mm-hmm. Because I do think often if you're trying to write for everybody, ultimately you're writing for no one. And it's through the specificity, like Get Out, right? Like when we interviewed Jordan Peele for our Sunken Place class, he mentioned that his first few drafts of Get Out, he didn't even know it was about race. He was sort of vibing to this idea of being the third wheel, like that person who's like not one of the college friends, but you're a date. So you're just mm-hmm. like everyone knows all the inside jokes. And, that might have been an interesting movie, but come on. Once he realized like the deep, like that this is a movie about what it feels like to be the only Black person in the room, mm-hmm. like at every damn meeting, in every damn class, this is what it feels like when the only thing people know how to say to you is like how much they like Tiger Woods, or they would have voted for Obama. And then if you start to look at it more systemically, because he said he thought of racism as individual bigotry rather than systemic, but then he started to realize, oh, it's systemic. What does that look like when you write a movie about visiting your white girlfriend's family and they have a body snatching operation? So I would argue that Get Out is a much better film because it's about race. Mm-hmm. because it's specific and it had this huge $250 million appeal. You can't tell me it didn't have a universal appeal.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what ultimately shook up the industry too, is that it had that universal appeal, even though it was like about race, because I feel like a lot of people try to shy away from that when it's like, no, we have to have these conversations because you should never forget what somebody's identity is, because you should always respect said identity.
There's no such thing as a generic person.
Exactly.
So if you're trying to write a generic person, then already you're off on the wrong foot.
Yeah. Mr. No Name. Yep. That's how it goes. Okay. So future projects. I know that you mentioned something. You said that you almost spilled the beans on something, so I won't like pry too much. But do you have anything that you can share with us about what you will be doing in the future?
Well, I'm working on a novel right now. It's hopefully going to come out next year, which would be great. And it's set in the world of a short story I wrote. It's in my collection, The Wishing Pool. But it first appeared in an anthology called Other Terrors. It's called Incident at Bear Creek Lodge. And it's a creature story in the woods, which I have been dying to write forever, because I will watch every single one of them. If it has lake, you know, bear, you know, like whatever, like I'm there. So, of course, right now the working title is Bear Creek Lodge.
Okay.
But I don't know if we'll end up changing it, but it's set in the world of my short story, Incident at Bear Creek Lodge, which is about the intersection of a creature story in the woods and racist Hollywood history. And I'm having so much fun writing it. I love the reformatory. I'm so glad I wrote it. But writing it was a misery.
Okay.
It's like the first time I've ever experienced a book that was really, really just not fun for me. Mm-hmm. Although I was trying very hard to make it fun for the reader as much as I could. Bear Creek Lodge is so much fun. And I feel like it's a reward for the reformatory. And hopefully people will like it as much.
That's awesome. That sounds really rad. And where can our listeners find you online and your work?
Absolutely. I always use my own name on social media. So for Blue Sky is my favorite home. But for now, I still do have a presence on Threads and Instagram. Mm-hmm. Really, the best way to keep in touch with me is to join my mailing list, Tanana Reeve. It's like banana with a T. So it's Tanana Reeve, R-I-V-E, list.com. And yeah, that's where you'll hear about my upcoming classes. We teach writing and Afrofuturism and science fiction and horror screenwriting. And we have the Life Writing Podcast.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on and speaking with me. This has been an honor. I was very stoked when I heard that you agreed to speak with me. So I want to just thank you so much for your time and for all of the wisdom that you've given me as well.
Well, thank you for the great questions. I appreciate it.
No problem. And dear listeners, you know the deal. Follow us on Patreon or bitchesoncomics.com or at queerspec.com. We are on Blue Sky. We got rid of Instagram. We couldn't take it anymore. So you can find us on Blue Sky at Bitches on Comics. And as usual, thank you, Kate, for making everything sound good. And thank you, SC, for being beautiful and lovely all the time. And until then, we will see you for the next episode. You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Bitches on Comics is a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Blue Sky and TikTok at Bitches on Comics. You can sign up for our newsletter, listen to any of our episodes, find curated lists of where to start listening, read interviews available nowhere else, and learn about our other projects and upcoming appearances at bitchesoncomics.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also buy us a coffee or send us a one-time morale boost at ko-fi.com/queerspec. That's ko-fi.com/queerspec.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to our Patreon page at patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Essie Fleenor, and you can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Blue Sky at essiefleenor. You know, the whole thing.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at my website, Audrey's Revenge Film, listed below. Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Church Fire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
If you like Bitches on Comics, you might also enjoy our narrative fiction podcast, Decoded Horror Channel, available wherever you get your podcasts or at decodedpride.com.
Be sure to check out our show notes to find a link to donate to campaigns engaged in important work.